The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Why is 399 such an important bear?
Well, she has symbolic significance for one thing, in that she is a mother who perennially has had groups of cubs, and females are the most important part of any grizzly bear population. So grizz populations rise or fall based on the number of females producing cubs. 399, because she's been so accessible, has become the most famous and widely recognized bear on Earth. And she lives in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and so millions of people have come to see her. International travelers have diverted their plans and made special trips just to Grand Teton National Park, hoping to catch sight of her.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Todd Wilkinson is my guest today, and we're talking about his book, Grizzlies of Pilgrim Creek, An Intimate Portrait of 399. This book is full of incredible images taken by naturalist and photographer Thomas D. Mangelson. How was he able to follow 399 and her offspring around to get such close-up photos of them?
Time. Tom Mangelson has traveled around the world to all of the continents photographing wildlife, and the only way that you can amass a portfolio like this is spending months of every year rising before sunrise, staying out until past dusk, trailing these bears, but not getting too close, because he's an ethical wildlife photographer. And so it became a matter of spending a lot of time outdoors, but he also had this network of people wired. So whenever sightings would occur of either 399 or her daughter 610, Mangelson would know where to go and then provide a stakeout in order to see the bears. He lives in Moose, Wyoming, which is inside of Grand Teton National Park. So if he heard a report of 399, he could pile into his car and be there in 20 minutes.
Speaking of ethics, when there were big crowds, he was really concerned about people getting too close to the bears, and he'd ask them to move back. And that's when they insulted him. What was that all about, aside from some of the tourists just not wanting to be told what to do?
Well, so this is the great paradox of Tom Mangelson. On the one hand, celebrating this bear, and on the other hand, large crowds amassing to want to see it. And so Tom would see tourists stumbling forward into this safe space that mama grizzlies have with their cubs, being very protective. And he knew that one incident could spell doom for 399. And so he and a cadre of photographers were very protective when it came to these animals, in some ways schooling people on the etiquette and the ethics of safe bear watching.
And so he would say, step back, and people would become hostile.
Indignant, saying, who are you to tell me what to do? And as a result of the mayhem that occurred, there was a special unit inside of Grand Teton Park called the Wildlife Brigade. And so working together with resident photographers, they really developed a protocol for what happens when the bear decides to cross a road amid a crowd of 500 people. How do you stop a temperamental grizzly bear mother from attacking someone who decides to come too close or throw food? Or, you know, we can only imagine the various kinds of scenarios.
What do you think this book will do?
Well, the upshot is that I know that 399 is now on the radar screen of bear managers in the region and nationally, for they're referencing her now. And they're realizing that these transboundary animals, in addition to be accessible, they're very important. You know, Jane Goodall, I had a conversation with her, and she said, You know, indeed, public land managers are responsible for managing at population levels with populations like grizzly bears. But in fact, people relate to animals on an individual level. That's their entree in. Rather than being nameless, faceless grizzlies wandering the wilderness, 399 has allowed people to become stakeholders and to better understand grizzly bears. And so if the book accomplishes anything, it's the hope of Tom Mengelson and I that grizzly bear managers consider animals like 399. And the interesting thing about her is that there's a version of 399 up and down the Rocky Mountain front. In every drainage where there are grizzly bears, there is a grizzly bear mother with cubs. And so I think 399 provides a window into understanding how bears live their lives.
It seemed to me from reading the book that 399 is important because she knows how to take care of her cubs and keep her distance from people without compromising her search for food. It's like she's socially aware or something.
Absolutely. And we have record numbers of visitors to national parks. We have a record inundation of lifestyle pilgrims, of people coming to live here. We have concerns about grizzly bear foods affected by climate change. And wilderness isn't growing, it's shrinking. So the habitat that bears need is actually impinging upon them. And so these bears, like 399, who cut against the stereotype of bears that are supposed to be vicious and aggressive, their savviness is going to become ever more important as we move deeper into this century. She allows us to open our eyes and understand grizzlies in a different way.
And she's training her cubs to do the same thing.
And that's probably the most important point. 399 was involved in a mauling early on in her life, and the decision was made to keep her alive in the population. And as a result of that, she had 15 offspring. That's why female grizzly bears are so important. But of those 15 bears descended from her, more than half today have been killed in run-ins with people or natural causes, such as big male grizzlies killing cubs because they want to mate with her.
I remember you writing about a male cub that was relocated to territory that the bear managers knew contained full-grown male bears, which meant he was in danger. And so, of course, he tried to get back to his home territory.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the criticisms aimed at the Wyoming Game and Fish Department is that they acted impetuously and moved this young male bear, which was the grandson of 399, and they moved him out of Jackson Hole just a few weeks prior to denning and moved him up northwest of Cody, where he got into trouble and ultimately ate a deer that was hanging in a tree. And so managers captured that bear and then euthanized him. And critics would argue that that was a decision that didn't need to be made, that if he had been allowed to roam a little while longer, he would have made it back to his natal den site and everything would have been fine.
There is a map in the book that shows the territory in the U.S. where grizzlies used to live 150 or 200 years ago, and the places they are allowed to live now, which are just tiny areas in the greater Yellowstone and Glacier National Park regions. And looking at that map made me wonder where they're supposed to go as they try to avoid people.
Well, exactly. So grizzlies have been reduced to 2% of their former range in the lower 48 states. And yet, there's this wonderful miracle that's happening out there. By protecting habitat, by reducing our lethality, by people carrying bear spray out there during their hikes and while they're hunting, we've reduced this lethality incredibly. And so areas in some ways are starting to become rewilded, not only with grizzly bears, but wolves. So these species that we deliberately eradicated, if given a chance, can come back. And if we keep our cool and better understand them, coexistence is actually possible.
I read somewhere years ago that the health of large predators, grizzly bears, mountain lions, wolves, indicates the collective health of everything that lives in any given ecosystem.
Absolutely. Where you have these apex predators, that is a sign of ecological health because their presence or absence shapes their prey populations. It does numbers of things, and we've heard about trophic cascades and how wolves have reset the Yellowstone ecosystem. You know, similarly with bears, large omnivores that eat meat and they eat plants. And a quick example of that is that after the cutthroat trout population collapsed in Yellowstone due to lake trout being introduced illegally, grizzly bears turned from eating fish and started killing elk calves with greater frequency. So there are numerous ways of ripple effects that occur when you either have a predator or when you remove them from the system.
You wrote that European bears are nearly genetically identical to bears in North America, yet their behavior is very different. Can you summarize that information for us?
Absolutely. So you've had thousands of years of people living in bear spaces in tight quarters. And so you've also had thousands of years of persecution. So the brown bears that exist in Spain and France and Italy have by necessity been forced to become far more cryptic, far less aggressive, and nocturnal. So you don't see bears during the daytime as you do here. Bears that have not been trained over time to run from humans every time they're seen. And so Frank Van Manen, who heads the Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Team and is Dutch, has looked at that phenomenon of the old world versus the new world. And what he concludes is that what we have with our brown bears, our grizzly bears in the West, is something that's really remarkable. We're able to peer back in time and see a truer nature of the beast than what's happened in Europe. They haven't been shot at, trapped, poisoned, really driven to the far, far edge of civilization and only allowed to exist with very, very limited tolerance.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Todd Wilkinson about his book, Grizzlies of Pilgrim Creek. If you'd like to listen to this conversation again or share this program with a friend, it's available as a podcast and also at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. You can also get there through our Facebook and Twitter pages. Coming up, a very strange story about an annual elk hunt inside a national park and the collateral damage that happens to grizzly bears because of it. Don't go away. The most bizarre thing in this book, to me anyway, is an elk hunt inside a national park. How is that even going on?
Well, people's eyes rise into the top of their heads when they hear that since 1950, there's been an elk hunt that occurs inside Grand Teton National Park. And so you have firing lines that have been set up, people driving elk, basically violating the laws of wildlife watching that exist for 10 months out of the year, and they're suddenly stalking elk and harassing them. And then amid it all, you have elk that have been shot and killed, and so you've got gut piles all over that grizzly bears are feeding upon. You have them on a collision course with people who have rifles in their hands, and so it's mayhem. It is the antithesis of how we're taught to behave and how we're taught to safely traverse grizzly bear country. And so we get into that. And what's interesting about this, again, is it relates to a transboundary issue no different from Cecil the Lion, where you're supposed to be offered sanctuary inside a protected area. And then if you wander outside of the boundary, you're open to potential sport hunting, trophy hunting. That's what happened with Cecil the Lion. And what Grand Teton National Park, the controversial hunt there, does is it really gives us a case study for understanding how perilous it is to be a grizzly bear in this ecosystem. We know from observation that grizzly bears actually respond to the shots of rifles. They equate it with a dinner bell. So if they hear a shot resonating, they may equate it with food, and so they will beeline in the direction of the sound, and so you may have hunters converging upon a game animal at the same time that the bear arrives. And so, as was shown this year, we have a near record number of bears that have been killed in the backcountry due to encounters with hunters.
What can people do to express their displeasure with this hunt in a national park?
It can be changed through congressional action. Grand Teton National Park also has some discretion with how they can structure the hunt. So if somebody is displeased with the hunt, the first thing they should do is pick up the phone and call the superintendent, David Vela, or write him a letter. Or better yet, is write a letter to the Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell.
You also bring up that U.S. taxpayers have spent millions of dollars on grizzly bear recovery in the greater Yellowstone region. And you state that, quote, the public overwhelmingly supports it, end quote. But isn't that human enthusiasm a part of the bear-human problem that's going on right now?
I wouldn't characterize it as a problem. One demonstration of that is that bears today are worth far more alive than dead. And we know that from economic statistics. In the greater Yellowstone ecosystem today, nature tourism, which has the two marquee attractions of grizzly bears and wolves, is worth more than $1 billion annually. That is a renewable, sustainable economy, and it's based on the fact that people are coming from around the world just to see these animals. In fact, there's data that shows that people will spend far more than twice what they pay, nearly, in entrance fees to just to come into Yellowstone National Park if they know the chance is heightened that they'll be able to see a grizzly bear. And so these so-called problems, the amount of money that we're paying to manage them, and I should note that we're actually managing bears pretty darn well as a listed species, is that these management problems are actually pretty small in comparison to the economic dividends that are being reaped in the ecosystem, and the fact that all of us in the Northern Rockies are proud of the fact that we live in an area so uncommon in the world that we have these large charismatic megafauna out on the landscape. And really, compared to the past, it's nominal impacts. They certainly impact some ranchers, but the federal government and the state agencies are very diligent in moving to address those challenges. And that perception shouldn't be extrapolated to prop up the belief that there is a pervasive problem with these animals, because there really isn't.
Say what hyperphagia is and why bears are more vulnerable and unpredictable when they're in that state.
Hyperphagia is a state that bears go into prior to denning. They try to eat as much food as they can to fatten up prior to slumbering for 5 months. And so it's particularly important for female bears who might be pregnant. It can determine whether the pregnancy will be successful over the winter. It can determine the health of their cubs. It can determine the health of bears in general that go into the den. So unless they ingest a large number of calories, either fats or proteins, it can affect their health, and it can affect whether a grizzly will have triplets or twins or whether she'll be pregnant at all. And so hyperphagia is this time in the fall when grizzly bears become much more aggressive in their wanderings for food.
And that coincides with elk hunting season. So you wrote about bears seeing gut piles and elk carcasses as really easy ways to get the food they want when they're in this brain-altered state of hyperphagia.
Absolutely. And several key food sources have gone into decline. And so what it's done is it shifted grizzlies away from whitebark pine toward more of a meat-based diet in the fall. And that also has huge implications in that by a factor of 5 to 1, you typically had male bears pursuing meat, and you had female bears pursuing other food sources. And now as female bears shift over, not only are they potentially becoming in have a greater chance of coming in harm's way with hunters during the fall, but in addition, male bears, like lions in Africa, they don't tolerate the young of females very well, because if you kill a young, it will put the female into estrus, and thus they'll be able to breed. So you have two things that are happening there. You have females having potential run-ins with hunters and ranchers, and you have females potentially running in to trouble with bears that would kill their young.
You described the difference between meat-eating bears and plant and fish-eating bears. What can you tell us about that?
Although bears eat 250 different foods, there are four main foods that serve as drivers in the population. One has been the seeds from whitebark pine cones. The problem is that the whitebark pine forest has collapsed 70 to 80% due to climate change and outbreaks of mountain bark beetles. And then on top of that, you've had Yellowstone cutthroat trout, which have been decimated by lake trout. Those fed more than 60 bears. And then you have army cutworm moths that migrate from farmland where they're treated as pests, and they gather in the high mountain talus, and bears by the dozens descend upon them and eat them. But those moths themselves eat mountain wildflowers that are threatened by climate change. And so as a result of all of this, is in a compensatory way, bears have shifted to meat. And so we know that when that happens, deaths spike, and in glacier, whitebark pine there collapsed more than a decade ago, and so bears have shifted. And all of this affects, according to Dr. David Mattson, who's probably the most published bear researcher, former study team member, what that means is that Greater Yellowstone, the core of grizz habitat, may be suffering from a depressed carrying capacity. Thus, the narrative that's being based to delist bears is that we have bears bursting at the seams, therefore they're showing up in places where they haven't been seen in 100 years. What Mattson is advancing is a potential theory that, in fact, the carrying capacity is in decline in the core of the ecosystem, and it's causing bears to range much further. So when we've been out on the road talking to groups, I ask the question, why did the black bears come into town? And without question, whether we're in Missoula or Bozeman or any of these Front Range towns, we accept the fact that black bears are coming in because it was a bad year for berry crops. And yet when we think about grizzlies, there are some who reject that they would range further in search of food. And so it's the same kind of phenomenon, well, with a different kind of bear, but it's one that really hasn't been seriously debated between those who advance the reason for delisting and those who are questioning it.
What do you think will happen if grizzlies are removed from the endangered species list?
If that moves forward, there is concern not only about the persistence of grizzlies, but the likelihood that the three states, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, will recommence a trophy sport hunt that hasn't existed now for since 1975. And it's very controversial because, again, the value of bears is far different today than it was when those animals were listed. And here's something else. One of the reasons people are concerned is that in Wyoming, when wolves were recovered, the state of Wyoming implemented a law that allows wolves to be killed over 85% of the state by any means at any hour of the day for any reason. That sets a pretty concerning precedent for grizzly bears. And indeed, part of the discussion today is that outside a zone, the primary recovery area, grizzly bears, too, may be treated as expendable, even on public land. And so critics are raising this question of will Wyoming follow a similar pattern that was established with wolves? And I should note that it's the only time in the history of the Federal Endangered Species Act where you've expended a lot of public resources to recover an animal, and then immediately inside a state, 85%, a state has basically revalidated eradication. And so the notion that grizzlies might be expendable, again on public land, it's a very controversial topic. So despite the proposal to delist, there is a very vigorous scientific debate being waged, in part in the public eye, but mostly behind the scenes, that talks about these key grizzly bear foods and whether the grizzly bear population is going to continue on the trajectory that it's on. There's no question that there are more bears on the landscape today when there were as few as 130 bears in Greater Yellowstone. Now there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 or more. But the question is that with the loss of female bears and with the loss of key foods, whether this can be maintained, and then if you add trophy hunting on top of that, what the ramifications will be as we move years down the road.
Todd Wilkinson lives in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about him and grizzlies of Pilgrim Creek at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, a weekly poem and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis and Tommy Emmanuel. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.